I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Kansas City Chiefs' failure to make it to the Super Bowl this year was unlikely to change the organization's fortunes quite literally. Why? Because 3 years of Chiefs tax documents showed that their win-loss record doesn't have that much impact on income. Today we'll talk with the reporters who saw those documents and learned how our NFL team makes its money. Then there's a proposal to merge St. Louis County and city into one municipality. We'll see how it compares to a unified government right across the state line in Kansas. We'll wrap things up with Brian McTavish and the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Kansas City Star got a hold of tax documents belonging to the Kansas City Chiefs, and the story spread across a football-crazed country just days after the 2019 Super Bowl. What do those documents show? A lot, actually. One key finding, there's little correlation between the team's on-field performance and how much money it makes. Another disclosure, the wildly exorbitant cost of parking that drives fans nuts is but a fraction of the team's overall income. The authors of the Star story join me now. That's Mike Hendricks, who joins us from his home. Mike, good morning.
Good morning.
Steve Vakrat joins us via Skype from his home. Steve, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm struck by how many media outlets, Steve, picked up your story. Why so much interest in the Chiefs, you know, across the entire country?
Part of it probably has to do with the fact that the Chiefs had a pretty good high-profile season, but I think a lot more of it has to do with how rare it is that we really get an unvarnished peek into the business of pro football or pro sports generally. These types of financial documents, they're business documents. They're closely held like they would be for any for-profit business. And, you know, a lot of what we have to go by in terms of how we evaluate the financials of pro sports are what they're willing to disclose. And, you know, a few metrics here and there, like attendance and things like that, that give us somewhat of a picture, but not a very broad picture. So this was a fairly detailed glimpse, even though the documents are a few years old, a fairly detailed glimpse in how the business of pro sports really works.
But Mike, these documents, these kinds of documents rarely become public. Am I hearing that right?
That's correct, Steve. There was a court case over free agency, I believe, back in the early 90s, in which a bunch of NFL financial records came out. But since then, nothing. They're all privately held companies, essentially, 31 of the 32 teams, except for the Green Bay Packers are a public institution, and they are the only window we have into the NFL's franchise's finances.
You know, Mike, these documents, as Steve just pointed out, are a little dated, you know, 2008, 9, and 10. Does that render their value, you know, a little less valuable?
Well, I don't think so. I think it gives us an idea of the structure of the of their finances. I mean, the numbers have changed obviously in the last 8-9 years. However, the income streams remain pretty much the same.
Steve Vakrat, why should we care about these numbers? Why do they matter? Why is this a big story?
Well, I think it contributes to the public's understanding of how NFL teams make their money. And as our story points out, you know, there's about two-thirds of the Chiefs' income in the years that we examined came from essentially the NFL. So about, you know, 2010, they made about $300 million. I don't want to bog your listeners down with too many numbers.
Right.
But about a third of that came from the league's national television contract. Another third of that came from these subsidiaries, if you will, of the NFL. One is a marketing subsidiary, and another one is for league-controlled media. That's things like NFL Sunday Ticket and the NFL Network. And what we found is that the money that they get from those two sources alone is enough to pay for player, coach salaries, which is their biggest expense, and still have money left over. And so I think, you know, it helps the public understand that, you know, these NFL franchises are very lucrative businesses, and that they can, you know, as you pointed out in your intro, the wins and losses have some effect on their financials, but not all that much. They can still make money regardless of how they do on the field.
You know, Mike, that was absolutely fascinating to me, this idea that the win-loss record doesn't necessarily impact the bottom line in a, you know, giantly significant way. What does that suggest about the way the NFL operates and the incentive that the owners have to always field a great team?
Well, as the Mark Donovan at the Chiefs explained to us, he said, yes, it's true, they do have that foundation, but they said they still have an incentive to perform well, because that improves their local revenue from sponsorships and the like.
So it still matters, at least to some extent.
Well, indeed. I mean, they did get like $50 million with, I think, for ticket sales.
Yeah.
So that does count. Every $10 or $20 million counts.
You know, Steve Achrodt, the way you guys began this story was by looking back at the team in the 1990s at a time when, even though the Chiefs were a big deal in town, the amount of money they were actually making apparently wasn't as big as you might think. These documents are from 2008, 9, and 10, when the team was beginning to make more money. Today, am I right, the TV contracts are even vastly more lucrative, which would suggest the team is in the soup a whole lot more now.
Yeah, and the Chiefs would argue that, you know, in that time their expenses have gone up, and that's true. I mean, the salary cap grows every year in the NFL, and, you know, there's some maintenance on the stadium that they have to pay for. But yeah, the TV contract is much larger now than it was at the time that these numbers were presented in 2010. And so, yeah, it stands to reason that the team is making a whole lot more money now. And we can extrapolate a little bit of that just from the Green Bay Packers financials, which are public. And so, yeah, the migration of the league's profitability and income streams has grown dramatically, mostly on the back of those television contracts.
Hmm. Mike, how did you guys come across these documents? How did that happen?
Well, I was just I learned of this tax case from the Jackson County Sports Complex Authority's financial report, which I was just breezing through in December, and I went poking around in a file in online and at that case and went through page after page after page, and suddenly there they were.
The Chiefs consider these documents, though, highly valuable. Why? And what would they? Why would they want to keep them out of your hands?
Well, they're a private business. No private business wants to have their finances aired. And I, as some would suggest too, that might give the Players Association or some other party they negotiate with some insight into their finances that might prove to their advantage.
Hmm. Steve Achrodt, so bottom line, how much did the team make during this era in team history, 2008, 9, and 10?
Well, in 2008, the first year we had the records, it was about $230 million, and that grew to about $302 million by 2010, which was the last year that we had the information for.
And you're talking profit here, right?
No, not profit. We're talking gross receipts.
Okay.
In terms of, you know, the profit's a little bit harder to tease out just from tax returns. I mean, these are state and federal returns, and so you don't have all the particulars of the business's finances. They're not all spelled out just from the tax returns, but we get a glimpse of how much money they bring in and from where.
How should we view these numbers? I mean, Steve, is that a lot for owning a professional football team? Is it not as much as you might have expected? How should we take this?
I think it was probably a little bit more than I expected. And it's, you know, one thing you can tell from the tax returns is that there was about, in 2010, there was about $40 million that was left over to be distributed to the team's owners, which are members of the Hunt family, mm-hmm. the four children of Lamar Hunt Sr. And that $40 million share was available to be split up roughly equally among the four children, 1% for Norma Hunt, who's Lamar Hunt's widow. Now, the team pointed out to us that they, of that nearly $40 million, the owners left about $20 million to be reinvested back into the team for various reasons. But it does give you a sense of how much money that can bring just to the ownership.
I was really struck by that, Steve. The family reinvested roughly half the money, the $20 million, back into the team. Any sense of why they would do that?
Well, I think at the time there, you know, at the time we're looking at was around the time that the Chiefs were finishing up some renovations on Arrowhead Stadium. And so I think some of that money may have gone to sort of help tie up some loose ends on that project. Not exactly sure why, but that's a supposition.
Well, let me get our listeners involved here if they have questions for Mike Hendricks and Steve Vakrod about their fascinating report in the Star about tax documents they came across that offer us an inside glimpse into the Kansas City Chiefs' financial picture. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. The NFL shares TV revenue. This is a very different financial operation than what we see in baseball. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, one thing I would say that, you know, to your point, yes, baseball lets its teams deal with the finances. You know, the teams strike their own local deals. And so what you end up with is a fairly large imbalance from one market to another. So, for example, as our story said, the Los Angeles Dodgers struck a local TV deal that was worth more than $8 billion spread out over 25 years. Mm-hmm. You compare that with the Royals, who are coming to the close of their current contract that pays them about $25 million a year. Wow. And that accounts for some of the disparity between the amount of money that the Dodgers can pay their players versus what the Chiefs or the Royals can pay theirs. And so, you know, looking at it broadly, what the financial model shows is that by sharing those TV revenues and other league revenues equally, the NFL has a lot of parity, and that's what they want. They want a competitive balance between their teams, and they would suggest that that's been a good model for them. And the franchises are relatively stable. You don't see situations in the NFL like you see, say, in the NHL with like the Phoenix Coyotes, which is a franchise that went bankrupt and was kind of a headache for the league to deal with. With the NFL, you don't really tend to see much of that.
What did you learn, Mike Hendricks? What did you learn about parking revenue and those big fees that the team charges to drive a car into the Arrowhead parking lot these days?
Well, I think we found that they were making about, or they're bringing in about $4.7 million, I think it was, in 2010 for parking. And that's when parking was $22 a car since on a regular season. Right now, it's this past year, it's $35 a car. We asked if the team if we could extrapolate that and basically just multiply the revenue by the percentage increase, and they said no, because some of those charges include new charges that they give to Jackson County. Mm-hmm. And they also say they have lots more expenses in parking now than they did back then.
Huh. You know, you guys obviously spent a lot of time diving into these numbers. Other than the fact that it's your job, why do you do it? I mean, why should people really pay attention to how much money the Chiefs make on parking or advertising deals or whatever, Steve?
Well, I think, A, it helps them understand a high-profile business in their community. Everybody was wrapped up in the Chiefs, and I think people's interest is generally, of course, on how the team plays on the field. But, you know, I think people who are making decisions about, you know, do I spend money on tickets? Do I go pay for parking at Arrowhead Stadium? Or, you know, this gets brought up sometimes too. Professional sports franchises are often asking taxpayers for significant help when they want to improve their stadiums. And I think some of these numbers can help them make some informed decisions about, you know, the team and how it makes its money, if and when the teams come back to the taxpayers for further improvements on whatever facilities they're looking for.
Mike Hendricks, there's really no doubt, though, here that the NFL and this team is financially healthy. I mean, you hear so much these days about kneeling and boycotts and concussions, but this franchise appears to be doing pretty well.
I don't think we're going to shed too much sympathy on the Chiefs right now. I think they're quite healthy and will be into the future.
Mike, what surprised you most about what you came across here? What was the most eye-catching thing?
The most eye-catching thing to me was the fact that we found the tax returns in the first place. I couldn't believe they were stuck in the public record, and that was a part of a fascinating story. I thought was the tug between the Department of Revenue and the Chiefs, the Revenue Department wanted to put them into the public record, and the Chiefs were adamantly against it. And in the end, the Department of Revenue just dumped them into the record without permission, and members of the Chiefs' front office were unaware of that until we told them.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what surprised you most?
A couple things surprised me. We talked a little bit about how there was close to $40 million left over for the for the owners. And to put a finer point on that, that's before taxes. The Chiefs are an S corporation, and not to bore your listeners, but essentially that amount would get reduced further through taxes on each of the shareholder, you know, each of the Hunt family members' personal taxes. And, you know, going even further on that, I was also surprised to learn that, you know, they didn't put all that money in their own pockets. They went ahead and reinvested in the team, at least approximately half of what was the share that was available to them.
Right. You said something else might have surprised you, too.
I think I was surprised by the fact that, so for 2008, we looked at ticket sales because that was broken out in their financials, and they sold about $51 million at the gate. And that was a terrible season for them. I think your longtime Chiefs fan listeners will remember that was a season they won two games. And then in 2010, which was the last year we had the numbers for, they sold about $41 million, even though they made the playoffs that year. And there were probably a few reasons for that. I think the economic downturn was in full swing by then, less discretionary income for people to spend on football. But I think, the Chiefs would also argue that, ticket sales are a little bit of a lagging indicator that, you know, if the team performs poorly the season before, ticket sales aren't good necessarily the following season.
That's really interesting. So, again, one loss records not necessarily really indicates how much money a team might be making during the course of any one year.
Right, that's correct.
Yeah. You know, every year Forbes magazine calculates the value of each team in the NFL. What do these figures suggest to you, Steve, about the accuracy of Forbes calculations each year?
They're somewhat accurate, but not exactly on the nose. And I've always been curious how Forbes does their calculations. But you know, in some respects they were close, but in others they weren't. The one thing that they do calculate, and I think it's kind of their top line figure that they put out, is the team's overall value. And I learned that you couldn't really extrapolate the team's overall value, which now exceeds $1 billion just from tax returns. You'd need more information than that.
So how does Forbes do it, Steve?
Well, I've guessed that they take they can probably start by extrapolating from publicly available information from the Green Bay Packers. From that, they can probably tell, you know, how much of a share they get from the league overall. You probably take average ticket prices and average attendance from the other teams, and you can probably put together a reasonable estimate on how all the other teams are doing.
Mike, what reaction did the Chiefs have that you guys got a hold of these documents, and did they ask you not to publish?
No, they did not. To their credit, they did not ask us not to publish. They they were aware that we had them, and they agreed to answer our questions, and were very polite.
Mike, were you surprised at how much interest there was in your story across the country? Because lots of sports outlets picked up on your piece.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I guess it's great to find out what it's like to be a sports reporter. because when you write about the Chiefs, you're guaranteed to get a national audience, I think, or about the NFL. But no, I was pleasantly surprised that it was picked up by a number of outlets.
Well, you can find Steve and Mike's story at KansasCity.com. I want to thank Mike Hendricks from The Star, Steve Vakarat, his colleague as well. Hey, thank you both for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the big proposed merger over in the St. Louis area where officials want to merge St. Louis City and county governments. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, Councilwoman Jolie Justice says her time in Jeff City shows her ability to work with others and to get things done. Hear why she thinks she would make the right candidate for Kansas City mayor. You'll find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, University of Missouri graduate and current U.S. Senator Tim Kaine of now of Virginia is back in town. Kaine is here to back his longtime friend in the Kansas City mayor's race. We'll ask him about that and his time in Kansas City. Well, in eastern Missouri these days, the talk is all about the big merger. That's the proposed coming together of the city of St. Louis and St. Louis County, a topic, it turns out, that's been kicking around over there since the 1870s. A merged city with a combined population of 1.3 million residents would make it the 10th largest in the entire country. What's behind the idea, and what can be learned from the merger of KCK and Wyandotte County that voters approved back in 1997? And how well has the experiment worked for the past 20 years? We're going to talk about all that right now. With us, Marius Johnson Malone is with Better Together. That's the group that has proposed the merger in St. Louis. He joins us this morning via Skype. Marius, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Carol Marinovich was the first CEO of the combined unified government of Wyandotte County. Carol, nice to have you back again. Welcome.
Good morning, Steve.
Marius, why do you guys want to do this?
Well, I think one of the things that we've realized in looking at our structure of government locally in St. Louis is that we're too fragmented and it is not allowing us to really thrive as a region in the way that you would expect for a place our size. You look at the 88 municipalities in St. Louis County, St. Louis County being separated from St. Louis City itself, and then the 55 police departments and 43 fire departments in St. Louis County, and you realize that we have a difficult time all being on the same page and operating with one voice, and we're also spending too much on our government services locally.
How will the merger, if it happens, how would that help?
Well, one of the things that is a challenge right now is that we have a real disparity in some key services around our region. So in some places, you have really great services around whatever you can imagine for municipal level services, whether that be policing or other areas. In other places, you have difficulty in getting even basic level of professionalism in some of the police departments here. And we want to make sure that we're able to change that. We also know that when it comes to seeking opportunities, whether that be economic or social or addressing some of our ills locally, we have a real challenge in being able to get on the same page and act in one accord. And so having a unified structure of government to address our problems and put our best foot forward would help us tremendously.
Carol Marinovich, as you're listening to all of this, does it sound like deja vu all over again to you?
To a certain degree, I would say, you know, within Kansas City, Kansas, you know, I think that one of the primary motivators was our community, quite frankly, was an older urban community that was dying, and there weren't a lot of economic development opportunities. It started at the grassroots level. And I know Kevin and Kelly and Mike Jacoby, who at the grassroots level, who really started the movement, they did a lot of research and looked at things that needed to be in place with other governments that had successfully consolidated their city and county and saw that we had a lot of those same attributes.
So as you listen to Marius describe the interest in St. Louis in doing this, do you think this could be a good idea, Carol?
Well, I think that would be up to St. Louis. You know, I can't respond for another community. I know it was right for mine. And one thing that I also learned, you know, with it being so many cities there, in my research, I visited Columbus, Georgia, and they had had a consolidated government for several years and met with elected leadership and business leadership there. And they all said that they didn't believe that their consolidation would have passed without strong elected leadership. And in that case, it was the mayor of Columbus who really helped push it. And so that need for political leadership, and I think that was required in ours, too.
Carol, how much support did the idea of unifying Wyandotte County government with city government wind up getting? What happened in the final outcome there?
Regards to the voters?
Yes.
Or the legislature?
The voters, yeah.
Regards to the voters, the problem you have is what has been Kansas City, Kansas, and Wyandotte County was no different than any other community. The minority community tends to be against it, and if you can understand their perspective. They have fought so hard to get where they are and actually have people sitting in government seats and elected positions. They're afraid of losing that and moving backward. And so our African-American community was no different. And if you look at those voting results, the majority voted against it. The other cities in the area also voted against it in majority. Overall, the voting, I think, was 60-40 countywide.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at Edwardsville and Bonner Springs, the other two cities, it was about 60-40 the other way around. Because you can't convince them that consolidation is not annexation.
Huh. Are you seeing, Marius, the same kind of resistance from voters of color in the St. Louis area to this idea?
Well, I think for a lot of voters, this is a fairly new concept, even though Better Together has been doing our work for 5 years and that this conversation in a broader sense has really been taking place over the last 100 plus years. For a lot of people, it's not been top of mind as far as civic issues are concerned, but we are starting to see some folks in parts of the African-American community have questions about representation. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that the task force that put together this proposal did was look very intentionally at those issues of representation and equity and tried to infuse those concepts and making sure that the new structure of government allowed for adequate representation to reflect the demographics of the region here locally.
Hmm. Carol, as you look back on it, what was the single biggest obstacle you had to get past?
At first it was the Kansas legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, it was members of the Wyandotte County delegation, my own delegation. Because at that point, some of them were from the old political machine, and some of them really weren't my political allies. And so where I got my support as a Democrat initially was from the moderate Republicans from Johnson County, along with a moderate Governor Graves.
You know, Marius, You know, Marius, what should poor folks who live in St. Louis City, you know, why should they sign off on this idea? What guarantees would they have that they won't be overlooked if a merger takes place? And I should tell you that we've had residents of KCK on this program complaining of being ignored even after the merger and not seeing the wealth earned from the western side of the county used to improve their lot out on the eastern side. So what about them?
That's a real uphill battle. As you said, Steve, in Kansas City, Kansas, you know, a lot of folks in the older parts of our community don't believe that they've received benefit. Even in reality, they have, because it has added to our tax base immensely to provide services to the community. And also, for the first few years when I was mayor CEO, we allotted like $500,000 a year from the new growth to go specifically to revitalization of the older parts of our community.
Hmm. Marius, weigh in here, if you would.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that people have hesitations about is any kind of change, and they're hesitant because they don't know what that would mean for their lives. I think that is reflective of everyone in our region, whether that be in poorer communities or in wealthier places. And one of the things that we would say is we know that what we have right now, particularly for poor residents in St. Louis City and St. Louis County, what we have right now isn't working. We've had gains in representation from an African-American perspective, but a lot of the leaders in those positions, frankly, don't have the resources available to them to implement the kind of changes that they know are needed in their community. And so we hope to be able to expand the tax base, but also make sure that we are spending resources where they're needed. Right now, we spend between $750 million and $1 billion more every year on local government services than some of our peer cities like Indianapolis or Nashville. We know that the resources are here locally. It's just how they're being spent and how they're being utilized. We think that we can achieve some efficiencies and be able to allocate those resources towards real needs in this community. And that absolutely includes low-income areas.
You're saying that because, in your view, there's a lot of duplication, Marius. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the thing that I think a lot of people in this area recognize is that we have a lot of government. You know, they know generally that there's about 90 municipalities and 50-some police departments. But then when you step back and think about what that means from a financial perspective, it also means that there are 90 mayors and city councils and 55 police chiefs and the subsequent management of those different areas and on and on when you think about the fragmentation of this system. And so there are efficiencies that can be realized from a monetary standpoint, and we can better allocate the resources that we have. We've seen in St. Louis since April 2012 over 130 local tax increases. This structure is not sustainable for us, and we need to make sure that we are doing things to better position ourselves for the future so that we're not continuing to raise taxes on our citizens, but we are realizing efficiencies and greater allocation of resources to the areas that need it, whether that's from a public safety perspective and increasing police in the areas that are lacking, or providing wraparound services like social workers or mental health workers for those who need those services that are related to public safety,
right.
Or from a child well-being standpoint. We know that we're not performing well right now, and the resources are currently in the system, and we need to think about how we deliver those services differently so that we can actually see some benefits.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about this proposed merger in eastern Missouri of St. Louis County and St. Louis City. You know, Mayor Marinovich, you know, one thing that strikes me as so interesting about this is sort of the emotional attachment that so many residents get to their communities and the names of their communities and the geographical boundaries of their locations. You know, Carol, I live in Westwood on the Kansas side, and there's been a little talk from time to time of merging us with Westwood Hills or, you know, other communities in the area. And people dig in their feet really quickly on that idea. And it bothers me sometimes a little bit, too. I'm not sure I can really justify it. What about that part of all this?
Well, I think, well, even in Kansas and Wyandotte County may be a unified government, but it's almost like no one lives in KCK. You live in Rosedale, you live in Armadale, you live in Argentine, you live in Piper. You know, they have their own little area that they want to, that they really identify with. It's home to them, and you're going to be protective of your home.
Yeah, Marius, are you getting some blowback because you're sort of messing with people's identities and in maybe some kind of way here?
Well, Steve, I can tell you that that has been a really strong message that has been delivered to our organization and to the task force members who sought community input for this. They saw a few things. People said that they recognize that what we have isn't working, and they wanted to see greater cooperation on economic development, on policing and courts, and more efficient use of tax dollars. But the other thing was exactly what you're saying, is people really value the cultural identities of the places that they live.
Yes,
and
yes.
I think that's reflected in the recommendations that the task force put together in the form of this consolidation. We are going to be continuing the current municipalities as municipal districts. They won't be doing policing and they won't be doing municipal court type work, but they will still have the opportunity to have parks and recreation, to have trash and recycling. For those that do fire protection, that would still remain with those municipal districts. And we want to make sure that the things that people really identify as being part and parcel to their community can be maintained on a large scale.
You know, Morris, deep down in your proposal is a call to phase out the earnings tax over in your neck of the woods. Why do you want to do that? Why is that part of this plan?
Well, I would say that it's not necessarily like something where was like the primary objective. But one of the things that I think a lot of folks recognize here is that the earnings tax is something that is not a favorite thing. It's been a necessary component of maintaining the financial situation in the city of St. Louis. But I think there's enough savings that can be realized. One of the things that will happen is that the election to reauthorize the earnings tax won't be able to take place under this plan because of the transition. All the elections are suspended to provide for some stability as we transition from one government to the next. And so in our planning, we wanted to make sure that there were sufficient revenues outside of that particular source to maintain a level of stability and a level of service in the region. And that's sort of the origin of the elimination of the earnings tax. And it phases out over 10 years, as you mentioned.
You know, I can't help but point out that this proposal is being bankrolled by Rex Singfield, who's a longtime vocal advocate of getting rid of the earnings taxes in both Kansas City and St. Louis. Is that a significant motivation here?
I can't speak for Rex Singfield. He is one of our financial supporters, but we have over 100. They're available on our website.
But he's the big one, though, right, Marius?
He is one of our largest financial supporters. That's right, but he hasn't dictated to us any terms about what this proposal should look like. He came to the table after our work had began and liked what he saw. And so I think it would be incumbent upon him and others to talk about what parts of this proposal they like. I think we probably can guess that that is something that he likes about the proposal, but it wasn't a motivating factor in how we came up with what to do to move forward.
Is it possible, Marius, if this thing passes over in St. Louis, that we might see a similar proposal over here in Kansas City?
I don't think that's actually very likely. I can't speak to what Mr. Singfield is his plans are, but I think the situations are different in Kansas City and St. Louis, and this proposal is very specific to only Kansas or to only St. Louis, excuse me. And I think we've crafted it in a way that should only be applicable to St. Louis. You know, I think the financial picture is different there, and I think the need for the earnings tax may be different. And so it should be looked at on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Carol Marinovich, what were some of the rough spots as residents of your county adjusted to this idea of the merger and merged life here?
Well, the advantage that we had was with that strong grassroots effort. And they had laid a lot of groundwork even prior to getting the legislation passed in Topeka that, quite candidly, the opposition didn't have good talking points at all. Their major talking points were, we support consolidation, just not this one.
Hmm. What improved for residents with the merger, Carol, as you look back on it now?
I think that they were willing to take a risk. The people who lived here really wanted to see it change and were willing to take that risk. One of the things that we had kept pointing out to them was the growth in other communities after they consolidated, and also how we would be able to lower the tax rate. The tax issue was the primary issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there, and we'll keep our eyes on what's happening over in the St. Louis area with this proposed merger. I'm going to thank Carol Marinovich, the first CEO of the combined unified government of Wyandotte County. Carol, I sure appreciate it. Thanks always.
Good talking with you again, Steve.
You bet. Marius Johnson Malone is with Better Together. That's the group that's proposing this merger in St. Louis. He joined us via Skype. Marius, thanks very much to you.
I appreciate the opportunity, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, Virginia's junior senator, that's Tim Kaine, will be here in the studio. He's backing one of the major candidates for Kansas City Mayor, Stephen Miller. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. Stay safe out there, everybody. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.